The Coming of Messiah, Part 5, Questions and Answers. Many legitimate questions were raised by readers over the information provided in the Coming of Messiah series of articles listed at the bottom of this page. Here is a sampling of some of the concerns over some of the scriptures that were not able to be addressed in those articles. Your last paragraph. There are three things we must remember about Hebrew prophecy. Totally confuses me. If these things are so, then I do not understand why Messiah sent his apostles to spread the good news to the world. I apologize if I misunderstand the message, but why would he, the Messiah, then be shepherd also of other flocks? Yes, the Hebrews are the chosen people, but I have been taught that his impalement was not limited to them, by Gideon. To properly understand the words of these Hebrew authors, we must begin to question everything we have been taught by others in favor of simply relying on what the words themselves say and actually mean. So the first thing to ask is, just what is the gospel message according to Scripture, not the tradition of religion? And what did it mean to those Hebrews that message was directed to? Words mean things, and if the life of Yeshua is the benchmark by which all things are measured, including other scripture, then what do the words on the pages of the book reveal to us about the gospel? They say that Yeshua went about preaching the gospel of the kingdom. Not one time does Scripture ever say that he preached the gospel of salvation, as Christianity teaches, neither from Yeshua nor from the disciples. So then, just what is this kingdom that Yeshua proclaimed? Preaching to the Gentile world about Yeshua is not mentioned in Scripture. In reading the entire chapter of Acts 17, one cannot help but notice that the only place Shaul, the Apostle Paul, speaks about Yeshua HaMashiach, the promised Messiah of Israel, not the Greek Christ, is in the synagogues to Hebrew audiences, the faithful in Yahweh, who understood the role of the prophesied kinsman redeemer to the nation of Israel, the family of Yahweh. Who does Paul speak about when addressing Gentile members of the Areopagus of Athens? Yeshua? No. He speaks of the one true holy Elohim of Israel, who created the world and everything in it. Not once does he mention Yeshua to these Gentiles. Not once does he proclaim or insinuate Yeshua to be the God, and yet, at the end of the chapter, we are told that some men joined him and believed. What did they believe in? It could not have been Yeshua because he was not even mentioned in the entire encounter. Christianity would tell us that Paul was speaking of Yeshua because of the doctrine of a triune Godhead, which tells us that since Yeshua is the Father, the words God and Jesus now become interchangeable. But that would be an assumption, a rationale overlaid upon these words from a perspective we have already concluded in our mind to be appropriate. The same Greek word translated as the English nations, ethnos, in Matthew 28 verse 9, is also used in Luke 7 verse 5, 23 verse 2, John 11 verse 48, chapter 18 verse 35, Acts 10 verse 22, chapter 24 verse 2, and chapter 26 verse 4, to refer to the Hebrew nation. Yeshua is telling them to go to the tribes of Israel where they have been scattered into all the Gentile nations. And verse 20 says literally, teaching to them to keep unto all to which I finished in you. Meaning, to make disciples of what Yeshua taught them. Because of Yeshua's sacrifice, the kingdom that was present in the garden with the first Hebrew, Adam, has now been restored to any who would embrace the words of Yahweh. By simply reading these words at face value, just for what they say and originally meant, the purpose of Yeshua's blood takes on an entirely different meaning from what most have been taught to believe. If what you say is true, then why did Paul expect the Lord to return physically and in person? Paul assured the Corinthians they would all receive their immortal bodies when the Lord returns. Paul assured the Thessalonians their dear departed dead would rise from the graves to meet the Lord as he descends and escort him back to earth. Peak. For as in Adam all die, so also in the anointed shall all be made alive. But each in his own order, the anointed, the first fruits, then at his coming, those who belong to him. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 23. The Greek word translated as the English coming in this verse is parousia, and in its usage literally means unto a being, beside, unto. Or more accurately, his presence beside. Where is Yeshua's presence today? If Yeshua has come to live and abide in you, has he not come to the earth today in you? Yahweh told Adam in the garden that in the day he eats of the fruit from the tree of the knowledge between what is good and what is evil, he would die. The blood covenant that had existed between Yahweh and Adam dissolved that day when Adam died. But Adam did not physically die on that day. In fact, scripture tells us he lived for another 930 years, with he and his family having an interaction with the present presence all during that time. Since we know that Yahweh is not a liar, then in what sense did the dying occur? There are only two places in Scripture where Spirit breathed upon men. The first was in the garden, where Scripture tells us that the breath of Yahweh became life to Adam, the first of the Hebrews. Scripture also tells us that the life is in the blood. So when Yahweh breathed life into Adam, it became his blood. Just as my son's blood carries the DNA of his father, Adam's blood carried the DNA of his father, Yahweh. Adam and Yahweh were Echad, Hebrew for one. They were in complete union, meaning the nature they shared caused them to be as one. Adam carried the essence of the nature of his father in his blood. That essence is expressed in the Father's glory, in his name, and in his word. Scripture tells us that what we do, what we give ourselves to, is what we serve, and what we serve is what we worship. Adam's disobedience to his father's word injected the darkness of self-determination into that nature, which is idolatry, thus corrupting the purity of the blood and necessitating a separation from being Echad with the present presence. There is a difference between adhering to the protocol that allows us to come into presence of the source of life, which has always been available even though externally, and being Ihad, one with the shared image of the Father of Light. Immediately after the separation, we see where Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel were still in his presence and heard his voice. Being Ihad, however, is a very different state of being. It is the same state Yeshua prayed those who followed him would become, just as, in like manner, in similar fashion, as he is one with Yahweh. The second time we find Spirit breathing on men is in John 20, verses 19 through 22, where Yeshua breathed breath of life into the disciples immediately following his resurrection, again imparting life. From reading both Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, and Acts chapter 15, verse 20, we can see that these Hebrews understood that the life is in the blood. Because of Yeshua's sacrifice, the first fruit, that kingdom that was present in the garden with the first Hebrew, Adam, has now been restored to any who would embrace the words of Yahweh. But we do not want you to be ignorant, brothers, concerning those who have fallen asleep, so that you don't grieve like the rest, who have no hope. For if we believe that Yeshua died and rose again, even so, those who have fallen asleep in Yeshua will Yahweh bring with him. For this, we tell you by the word of Yahweh, that we who are alive, who are left to the coming of Yahweh, will in no way precede those who have fallen asleep. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 through 15. Are you aware that the name of Yahweh appears over 2,500 times in Scripture? Yet not once does his name ever appear in any of our modern translations. It has been replaced in these translations by the names Jehovah, Adonai, or Lord, none of which have an equivalency to what appears in the original Hebrew those scriptures were written in. Wherever you see the capitalization of Lord or God in the scriptures, that is where the name of Yahweh appeared in the original manuscripts. Why do you think that is? Did that just happen by accident? A quirk? Or was it by design? Does the term replacement theology come to mind? Things became really muddled when the translation of the Messianic writings, because of the carryover of this agenda of the translators to enhance the doctrine of a triune Godhead, which tells us that since Yeshua is the Father, the words God, Jesus, and Lord now become interchangeable. But for these Hebrew writings, these letters from a Hebrew perspective formed out of a Hebrew mindset that was influenced by a Hebrew culture and were addressed primarily to a Hebrew audience which understood the nuances of the Hebrew language. There is only one coming, the Day of Judgment. The Greek word translated as the English Lord is Kyrios, which means supreme in authority. Yeshua said in John 14:28 that Yahweh was greater than he was, and while Yahweh has given Yeshua all authority to complete the task he was given, Paul says it is plain that Yahweh is expected from that authority. So these Hebrew authors were well aware that there is only one coming mentioned in all of Scripture, the day of Yahweh, and that is what all of these words are alluding to. Throughout the Tanakh, events and circumstances are often described using a form of phrasing called figurative imagery, language used to represent objects, actions, and ideas in such a way that it appears to our physical senses. Since the word imagery is associated with mental pictures, imagery makes use of particular words that create visual representation of ideas in our minds. Yeshua frequently used this Hebrew technique in his parables to illumine a particular truth he was trying to convey. So it is we find the continued usage of the figurative imagery in the Messianic writings of these Hebrew authors who understood how wording could invoke a mental image to convey the sense of what they were writing about. We find this type of imagery in the phrase, fallen asleep, which is used throughout Scripture to describe those who have died in anticipation of the day of Yahweh. Since there is no time in eternity, consequently, this is only a split second between a person's death and their resurrection. This is why Scripture describes those who have died as being asleep, because when you're asleep, there is no conscious awareness of the passage of time. Events that may be separated by hundreds or thousands of years in our time frame can pass in eternity, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Stefan wrote to ask, what is the Hebraic view of Luke 17 verses 23 through 24? For as the lightning, when it flashes out of the one part under the sky, shines to the other part under the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day. Luke 17 verse 24. In the same regard, we see the figurative imagery being used in Yeshua's response to the question posed in Luke 17:20, when the kingdom of Yahweh would come, and he explains that it would not come by observation because Yahweh's kingdom is now, within or among those who embrace his life, meaning it cannot be observed with the naked eye. This same wording concerning his coming will be as lightning is also found in Matthew 24, verse 27. Here, he is using imagery invoked from two different Hebrew sources, the first being found in Psalm chapter 103, verse 12, which says, as far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. Like a father has compassion on his children, so Yahweh has compassion on those who fear him. Supporting Yahweh's plan and purpose for the kinsman redeemer to restore the kingdom of Yahweh to his family of Israel. The second source invoked in this imagery is the use of the Hebrew word halal, translated as the English word praise, which means to flash forth light, and is speaking of the sign of the Son of Man in Matthew 24, verse 30, which will be seen as lightning through the brilliance arising in the lives of his followers. This has a significant meaning, often overlooked because he is not talking about a physical sighting, but his sign. The English word translated as sign comes from the Greek semeion, which is frequently misunderstood to mean a miracle, like signs and wonders as something externally visible. The primary definition of this Greek word, however, more accurately correlates to being a signature token on the order of the signet spoken of in the Kinsman Redeemer series of articles. Proof of identity, identifying characteristics, a pattern of events or phenomenon that identifies a point in time, a token that can be used for identity or proof. Therefore, Samion in this passage describes a set of events and phenomenon that would occur where the characteristics are so compelling, unique, and identifying that as to make it impossible to deny the identity or purpose or concept of the Son of Man. The scriptures do not teach the immortality of the soul. Rather, they reveal it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment. So Yeshua, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to rescue from death those who are eagerly awaiting for him. Neither do the scriptures reveal that when one dies, the soul goes to heaven or hell, leaving the body behind. Rather, it clearly shows that when one dies, they await the resurrection of the dead, both of the righteous and of the wicked. The apostles were witnesses that Yeshua was resurrected from the dead, fulfilling the promise of Yahweh that is vital to others within his family, having the hope of also being raised from the dead just as he was. Simply put, the second coming of Yeshua occurred at Yom Shavuot, and we are living in the millennium right now. The only other coming expected in Scripture is the day of judgment, the day of Yahweh, which will be that time when his spirit will prevail over the spirit of man, the spirit of Yahweh and those who have become him. Yeshua and the saints will be manifest on that day. Yeshua is our visible, tangible hope of glory manifested in us to this world. For Yahweh himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the chief angel, and with the blast of the shofar. The dead in the Messiah will rise first, then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet Yahweh in the air. So we will be with Yahweh forever. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 through 18.